Hi, my name is Joyce. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 24th, 2005. I have a sponsor and a home group and the privilege of sponsoring other women. And thank you so much, Billy, for asking me to come out and share. I love coming out to this group. I've been able to come out here, I guess, since I've gotten sober, you know, for every couple of years. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, they become our family. They get to see us grow up here and see our lives change. And they're good fact checkers, too, so because I know Lynn and Billy know my stories. So if I start talking weird, they'll probably put a hand up and be like, that's not what happened, you know. But I'm truly privileged. I mean, everything that is good and decent in my life is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to hear people say that and hear people say that they were grateful alcoholics, and I felt so annoyed, you know, and I felt like they were full of it. You know, who could ever possibly feel that way? And I felt almost sorry for you, you know, that's what a sad life you live, that if that's the best part of your life, you know, I feel sorry for you. And I can honestly say that that's the truth for me today, you know, that I truly, everything that is good in my life is a direct result of the actions that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to take, you know. Me left to my own devices, I am self-destructive to the core, and I cause chaos and havoc for everybody else whom my life touches, you know. And I'm happy to say that it's the opposite today. And today I try to live a life that I touch favorably upon the people around me. And so I'll share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and how I try to live today. And my journey here in Alcoholics Anonymous, however faultingly it's been, you know, my story starts. I was born and raised in New Jersey. I told Billy that I'm purposefully trying to talk slower because I'm still through and through a Jersey girl, and I'll just start going, you know. And a lot of times we're like, I only understood like 25% of what you said. So I've been trying to slow down. and you know, I grew up in Jersey. I grew up with a family of drunks, and I don't mention that because it made me alcoholic. I mention it because it gave me a lot of access to alcohol. And I also mention it because it gave me a lot of examples of why I should have never started drinking to begin with, you know, and I couldn't. I could tell you that before I ever picked up a drink, I experienced what, you know, people here in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about is that spiritual malady, that even before I ever picked up a drink, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I didn't have vocabulary words like that to describe it. You know, I felt alone. I felt anxious. I felt separate. I felt apart from. And I felt weird, you know. So when I took my first drink, when I was 10 years old, I was good and ready for it. You know, I was wound tight, my head was loud, I couldn't breathe, and my first drunk was off a Johnny Walker Black Label. And when I took that stuff down, I mean, something happened to me, you know, and I experienced that night the effect produced by alcohol, you know, that ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks that only people like us experience. And I know that normal people or non-alcoholics have a great time drinking, and they too experience, you know, an ease of comfort from drinking. You know, you can go out, you know, to any downtown area on Friday, Saturday night and see people feeling relaxed and feeling happy and having a great time, and they're drinking. And, you know, but for me, it was so much more than that. You know, when I got drunk, it changed my perception. Changed my perception of who I was. It leveled the playing field in a way that my life depended on it, you know. And for the first time, it was like the lights came on, and exactly what Bill Wilson describes, I mean, I had arrived. You know, I've been waiting for that feeling like I had arrived. And once I got that drunk, it released something in me where I felt like I could live, you know, in the same world that you all were living in. And I chased that feeling, you know. And also what I always like to mention is that on that first night, I experienced one of the first feature of alcoholism, you know, that I was taught, which is the physical aspect. I experienced this phenomenon of craving. When I drink, I get thirstier. And that night, I was drinking with some other punk kids, you know, this boy that I've been stalking for 3 years. And, you know, they got an effect produced by it, and they drank a couple glasses. But for me, I mean, I drank a couple glasses, and no one had to force me or encourage me. I mean, I intuitively wanted more. And that was something that would continue for the, you know, for throughout the rest of my drinking, is that when I start, something wakes up inside of me and I need and want more. And that's what happened that night. You know, I kicked these kids out of my house, and I killed that bottle of Johnny Walker myself. And that's what my drinking would start to look like. You know, for the next couple of years, I would take water bottles of liquor at a time and then handles of liquor at a time. I became daily drinker. You know, I would drink in the morning, drink at night for a nightcap. And no one had to teach me to do this. You know, it was as natural as breathing or blinking. And it made sense. You know, it would make any time I'd have to make contact with the outside world, it just made sense that I would need something in me. You know, and I had no idea that what was developing was this dependence on alcohol. And I had no idea that I began crossing these lines where I would begin to lose and lack proper control. And what that looked like for me is that within a couple of years, I had my first intervention, you know, people crying at you, screaming at you, you know, and it started the merry-go-round of sending Joyce to treatment and therapists and, you know, substance abuse counselors and priests. And everyone's trying to figure out what's wrong with Joyce, you know, because, you know, immediately, right, kids drink at young ages. I mean, that's the reality, but they're drinking like wine coolers, you know, and there was something always weird about my drinking. Like, I'm checking proofs of the bottle, you know, because I'm like, I drink for effect, and I hoard, and I'm selfish, and I began experiencing what would dominate the majority of my drinking, which was this unpredictability. You know, I wasn't, for the first couple of years, I could drink as much and as often as I wanted, and I could just be a good time, you know, life of the party, party girl Joyce, you know, and it'd be a good, like, we'd laugh a lot, we'd do, you know, crazy, reckless things, and everything would be fine, you know, but I crossed this point where then eventually I would drink and I couldn't tell you what was going to happen that night. More likely than not, it was not going to be a good time, you know, that I would become hostile, suicidal, you know, combative. I couldn't, in the beginning, I could drink as much as I wanted, and it seemed like I just was a bottomless pit, you know. I had this freakish tolerance, and I would just be fine. And then eventually something started to happen with the way that I ingested alcohol, that one night I could be halfway through a handle and be still operating. And the next night I would take 4 shots and I'd be blacked out, you know. And the next night I'd have 2 beers and I'd be passed out. And it was the inconsistencies drove people crazy, because they were like, what's going to happen, you know? And nobody wants to drink and party with a girl like that, because people get tired, you know? People get tired of babysitting you, get tired of picking up the pieces, get tired of the morning after phone calls and worried looks, and, you know, and it would drive people insane, because, you know, I would cause some sort of chaos the night before, ruin some sort of relationships, physically attack one of my friends, and then the morning after, I'd come to and be like, hey guys, what are we doing today? And people would be like, what's wrong with you? You know, do you know what? And, you know, they didn't stop asking me that. They stopped asking me, do you know what you did last night? What were you thinking? Why did you drink that much? You know, because I didn't have a sufficient answer to those questions. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, I mean, I can't sufficiently answer those questions, because I had no idea, you know, that I was drinking to overcome this craving. And I had no idea that despite however much love or support or friendships or consequences that I would face or have, that would not be enough to keep me from drinking, you know. And so, you know, it began. I had to move from groups of people to groups of people. I would, you know, constantly making promises, breaking them, constantly starting day counts and then stopping them. I began the great obsession to control and enjoy my drinking owned me. You know, I identify with the chapters that describe, you know, all the ways that we tried to beat this game. You know, I switched brands. I tried other substances. I changed groups of people. I have gone into the woods in camps and tried to reenact my childhood with foam, you know, pillows, beating pillows and screaming into them, you know. I have acted like in my inner child. I have really gone out there and tried to seek and figure out what's wrong with me, and no one could even come close. You know, no one could come close. And there are a couple of turning points in my drinking that, you know, changed the trajectory of my life. The first one being in the middle of my drinking, in the middle of a spree, my mother had a brain aneurysm and died. And the reason why I always mention that is because it was a turning point in my drinking where two things happened. You know, the first thing is that I made the most sincere promise and oath that I'd ever made in my life, you know, not to drink ever again. Because I was disgusted with myself. My mother was a saint in my life. She's the only person who loved and cared about me and never abused me in any way. And I thought, you know, for her sake, as much love that a selfish, self-centered animal like me could muster up, that I would be able not to drink. And let me tell you, I couldn't even make it 48 hours until I was drinking again. You know, and the second thing why I always mention that is that it changed the trajectory of my life, because then it was just me and my drunken father in New Jersey. So then we could drink round the clock. And it was like someone took the brake off of a vehicle. You know, I was like, I could just go as fast and as hard as I wanted, and nothing was going to stop me. And that's what we did. You know, for the last 4 years that I was up in New Jersey, me and my dad, we drank round the clock, passing out, blacking out, falling down, beating each other up. And I became such a victim, you know. I could, and no one could come close, because it's like, not only did I have my mom died card to pull on you, you know, when they were picking me up out of alleyways and parking lots and wooded areas, you know, but I had my father's an abusive drunk card. And it's like, you know, it's everybody else's fault. And no one could come at me with my responsibility, with my actions, and I loved it. You know, it was a free pass, and it took me a lot of inventory here in Alcoholics Anonymous to even acknowledge that, you know, to see that I wasn't a victim, that I wasn't some poor child, you know, that I was an equal player, and I manipulated and used those circumstances to my advantage. And after 4 years in New Jersey, I had burned up the rest of the bridges that I had. You know, my family had given up on me, and I just wanted to start over. So I came down to D.C. to try to do that, you know, to recreate our life. We coined it here as a geographic. You know, I didn't know that that's what I was doing at the time. I really thought that if I could just hit the reset button and start over, I can rebuild, you know, because I'm good at that. Alcoholics are so good at rebuilding our house of cards, drunk and sober, you know, and then tearing them all down. Because I'm good. I can hold my breath, you know, for so long to win over your approval, to win over some sort of trust. And, you know, I can be driven, but only for a little while, until my insides start getting tight again and my head starts getting loud and I start getting that restless, irritable, and discontent. And I begin to experience that second feature of this illness, which is the obsession of the mind. You know, my mind is insane, and I would stop, and I would, all of a sudden, my mind would just justify, you know, this is how it's going to be different this time, or this is why it was somebody else's fault last time. And when I came down to D.C., you know, I thought, well, this is a fresh start. Nobody knows me here. I don't have that reputation. I don't have that emotional baggage that I had in New Jersey, so everything's going to be different. And I landed into Reagan and International Airport, and that same night I was coming to on a dirty bathroom floor doing all the same things, surrounded by all the same people. I mean, I couldn't escape myself for one day. And people like us, I mean, we're like magnetic forces, you know. I mean, I will find the most messed up, toxic people in any given area, you know. It's just like I had a device, you know. And so when I came down to D.C., this was, you know, and if you're new tonight, this is kind of like the what happened part. You know, I had no intentions of getting sober. I had no intention of asking for help. My last year or 2 years in D.C., or no, a year and a half in D.C., was anything remotely social or glamorous about my drinking had changed. You know, that was long gone. And there was no acting like I'm trying to just be a normal person. I mean, I had surrendered that, and I entered the phases that Bill Wilson talks about with that desperation drinking, you know, where I'm not trying to catch a buzz. I'm not trying to even get that ease and comfort anymore. I mean, I want oblivion. I want to be put out of my misery. And the darkness of that year, I mean, literally drove me back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it surrendered me in a way that I know is a gift. Because I had that gift of desperation, and I didn't have it right away. You know, my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was first in 2004. I blacked out on a rooftop. A girl picked me up from that rooftop and 12-stepped me. You know, I came to one morning, and I was clothed. And I was laying on a couch, and this little girl named Kunzel, you know, came bouncing over at me. She was, like, not even 5 foot tall. And, you know, this young girl, and I didn't know who she was. I didn't know why she took me in. What I came to find out later that, you know, she was like 2 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and she was 22 years old, and she saw me as a ripe alcoholic, and she was like in that newcomer, like pink cloud, you know, evangelical phase. And she was, you know, I mean, she was like exactly how Bill Wilson described, you know, just brimming over with self-confidence. You know, she was a woman that was armed with facts about herself. And what I experienced that morning was the language of the heart. And it was the first time. And what this girl did for me, she planted the seeds of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know why. You know, I, prior to that day, have been in front of many professionals, many well-intentioned, loving family members and friends, and no one has been able to reach me, you know, that I could barely hear anyone other than myself on any given day. You know, when people talk to me, it was like that wah, 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 wah. Like, I saw your lips moving. Nothing was ever registering, you know. And for some reason, when this girl spoke to me, I heard her in a way that I had never heard anybody in my life, you know. And for the first time, I felt like this girl gets it. She understands my crazy. She's not asking me questions I can't understand. She's answering questions I didn't even know I had, you know. And she was explaining things with a language that, you know, it was like filling. It was like putting a puzzle piece together, you know. And I realized that I've been missing essential pieces, like the spiritual malady factor, you know, with the, like, this phenomenon of craving, this thirst. And she was piecing it all together to me, and she had me sold. You know, within 15, 20 minutes, she had me sold, and I caught myself nodding and laughing and smiling and agreeing to go to AA with her. And for somebody as stubborn and self-centered and self-sufficient as I am, that's pretty remarkable, miraculous, you know. And that's the power of AA, and that's why it works, you know. And I went around meetings. I got a sponsor. I got a big book, but I absolutely identified out. You know, my ego does not go down easily. And I don't surrender well, you know. I want to do things my way. And I think a lot of times my case is different. You know, my case is different. I'm too complex. My circumstances are different. And I just could not submit that these simple steps that you all had up on the wall was an answer for me. You know, and a lot of these words offended me, like powerless and God. And, you know, I just would not submit to this process. And after a little while, I went back out. And in that last year that I went back out, I mean, I ended up picking up heroin and other substances, and it catapulted me into what would be my bottom, you know. And I always mention it because it expedited my bottom, you know. And I came to on April 24, 2005, my sobriety date. That's the day after my dad's wedding. My last drunk was my father's wedding. He was getting remarried in New Jersey. I don't know why I went, but I wanted to go and, you know, be out of pride, honestly. I wanted to show them that I was doing well in D.C., you know. And I really thought that I could stay sober and hold it together for 24 hours. And I went up to that wedding, and I couldn't do it, you know. I could not do it physically. And so I drank. I ended up blacking out, falling down, you know. Being a huge embarrassment to my family and my dad, and we were laughing about it. We can laugh about it now, but I mean, from his wedding, and I don't know if anybody's been ever a part of planning a wedding or having a photographer at a wedding. I mean, they take like 800 photos, and there is not a single photo of me. They like literally digitally removed me from that day. I mean, like, because I was disgusting, you know, and I don't, and only, it's literally taken probably this, the last 10 years for people to feel comfortable, my friends and family, to feel comfortable enough with disclosing the actual facts that happened that day. You know, how I threatened people's lives, how they had to babysit me, how I burned people with my cigarettes, and, you know, I had to be carried out. I mean, it was humiliating and disgusting. And I used to say that it was nowhere near my worst drunk, and that may be true in some extent. You know, I've experienced a lot of incomprehensible demoralization and been in situations that I never wanted to be in and things like that, but the effect that that night had on my family, you know, the people that cared and loved me the most in this world, I will never know the impact, you know. And I remember just 2 years ago, I was sitting down with my cousins that found or babysat me that night. And even as then that was like 8 years after the fact. And still, when they were telling the story, they still were crying. You know, and I had been sober, I had made amends, and that is the amount of pain that people like us, you know, this alcoholic causes. And I'm a blackout drinker. You know, I will never comprehend the destruction of that I caused. And I always like to say that because it reminds me that my debt here will never be paid. You know, that I have to live right here in Alcoholics Anonymous to make that right, you know, and hopefully, God willing, for the rest of my life. But so on April 24th, I came to. I took a bus from New York back down to D.C. I took phone calls from my family members doing the same thing that they had always done, crying at me, yelling at me, you know, begging and pleading. And for the first time in my life, I didn't have a sufficient answer. I didn't have some lip service. I didn't have any blame to displace. I just shut my mouth and I took it in. And there was a part of me that, and I hear this all the time when people talk about the what happened, you know, that this moment of grace, you know, this window of willingness and this feeling of being so tired that I didn't have another game to run, another plan or design, you know, I just was beaten down and broken. And I just wanted to lay down and die. You know, and I didn't use or drink that day. And by the 25th, when I woke up, I was going through detox and withdrawal. My junkie friend put me in a cab. That cab took me to a clubhouse. I stayed in that clubhouse for 4 days. On the fourth day, I was, you know, physically feeling a little better. I wanted to go back to my apartment. And already the insanity was back on me. If I just drink wine like a lady, if I, you know, if things will be different this time. And, you know, the wheels were starting to turn. And but for the grace of God, you know, my plans are interrupted. And what happened that day was around like 8:30, this girl who lived in the floor underneath me, her name was Julie, came to my door, knocked on the door and asked me to take her to an AA meeting. What the probability and odds are of that? You know what I mean? It's like almost comical that, I mean, it's undeniable that there has always been a presence that has been guiding me back to you all, you know. And then she had no idea that I'd been detoxing for 4 days, no idea that I had come up with the plan to drink wine like a lady, you know. She was dying, she of her own illness, whatever it was. She had had a rough weekend, and all she knew was that the girl upstairs had been to AA the year before. So, you know, I took her to a meeting. And again, I don't know what possessed me to do that. I'm not like a do-gooder helper. Yeah, I'm not like somebody that you, like a neighbor that you knock on the door and ask for help, you know. I'm a recluse and I'm a taker. And I don't know if it was the example that girl Kunzel set for me or what AA had already planted in me or whatever God that was moving through me. But for some reason, you know, I called a cab and we called the AA hotline and got an address and we went to a meeting, you know, and we went to the Foggy Bottom group, still meets on Thursday nights at 8:30. And what happened from that point forward, you know, till today, I know is the loving presence of a God. And we went into that meeting and I went inside that meeting and I just broke down. You know, I broke down in a way that I hadn't in, I don't even know if ever in my life. You know, at my mother's own funeral, I didn't feel that amount of sincerity and vulnerability, you know. And I'm convinced that there's a power in this room, you know, where alcoholics gather when we have these meetings, that there was an absolute power in that room that moved my spirit. You know, and I broke down in a way, obviously, like that newcomer cry, you know, and people ran over after the meeting. These guys got on their phones and they called women from Alcoholics Anonymous to pick me up for meetings, you know, and they babysat me. They picked me up every single day, sometimes twice a day, taking me to meetings. And, you know, those women saved my life. They showed me how they were living. You know, they were clean and they were happy and they were whole. And I had so much repulsion from it, you know, because I was so unhappy. I remember my first sponsor driving me home from our home group, which they took me to. I was so overwhelmed when they took me to that home group. It was like, at that time, 400 people in D.C. And I just felt like such a broken soul. And here they were looking like a Gap commercial, you know, just like dancing and happy and laughing. And, you know, it was like blinding for someone unhappy. And yet at the very same breath, as much as I hated you all, I desperately wanted what you had, you know. And I remember her driving me home saying, "Joyce, you never have to live like this again." And me thinking, what are you talking about? You know, I had no idea what this woman was saying, you know. And later on, it would be pointed out to me in the book about the jumping off place, you know, that an alcoholic of our type at this point, you know, I cannot imagine my life drinking anymore. But at the very same time, I cannot imagine my life any other way. And I wish for the end. And that was absolutely where I was at, you know. And my sobriety has not been, you know, an easy path or a bed of roses. It has been absolutely difficult, you know. And I'm, you know, many of my spiritual teachers would say that this, you know, that this spiritual path, that a price was going to have to be paid, and it meant destruction of self-centeredness and changing everything about myself, you know. And that it was simple. The concepts were so simple, like, but for an alcoholic like me, it would be the most difficult thing that I would be ever asked to do. And so what that looked like for me, my sobriety, you know, my early sobriety, I was definitely a newcomer that was high dramatics, I would say. I was someone that, you know, for the first, and I was swept up by this home group, you know, they babysat me, I got a sponsor, I got involved, I got in service, but I had no idea the level of my self-centeredness. I mean, to this day, it's almost shocking, you know. I mean, I put down the drink and I'm left with myself, and it was like I had no tools for living. I could almost be described like a newborn baby, constantly crying, confused of whether I wanted to be held or put down or hungry, you know. I mean, I just had no concept of what was going on with myself. I was unbelievably uncomfortable in my own skin. I experienced compulsions and obsession to drink. That was something that was not lifted from me right away, you know. And I felt the powerlessness and the unmanageability that they talked about in that first step. You know, I began to understand the true nature of what this illness was, and that, you know, at the root of it, that selfishness and self-centeredness, that was my problem. You know, that my drinking was just a symptom of it, because I hadn't been drinking for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And here I was, you know, an insane woman, and I could not function. And I thought my whole life, I just thought I was this hyper capable and accomplished person that could do anything. And every day I'd be in fetal position, hiding in the bathroom floor, you know, whispering on the phone to my AA people during the work day, wondering how I was going to make it until the night meeting, you know. And it was such a humiliating and humbling experience, because what it did was it forced me to ask for help. And it forced me to see that I absolutely, in that second step, need something bigger than me, you know, because I couldn't beat this thing on my own. And when it talked about, we were talking about it on the way down here, that lack of power is my dilemma, that I need to find a power of which I could live. And that's what the rest of these steps were designed to do, is to connect me with this power, you know. And I'm grateful that I fell into a sponsorship family that took me through this book and showed me, you know, because I was also like a meeting maker. I was, you know, that was like the first thing that I had retained from my first round of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I just went to a lot of meetings. I liked being able to take people hostage at the meeting. I like to take the whole meeting hostage, you know. I like people like committees on how to fix Joyce and make me feel better, you know. I mean, so I'd go like 3 meetings a day and still be wanting to drink at night, and I was so mad, like, AA's not working, what's wrong with this? And my sponsor explained to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was not the meeting. You know, that Alcoholics Anonymous was a way of life and a program of recovery outlined in this book through these steps, and I would need to take these steps on my own, you know, because, and we were talking about this earlier too, I mean, I was such a spiritual thief, you know, I'm like, I'm always looking for shortcuts. I want somebody to fix it, always, my whole life, you know, I'm just like a petulant child, fix it, you know, poor me, take care of me, and I would want people to just fix what was wrong with me rather than having to work through the experience myself and grow through it. And that would be a common thread throughout my sobriety, and still that's something that I struggle with to this very day, is like having the maturity, you know, and the faith to be able to walk through something, through the difficulty, through the pain, with the faith that I'm going to grow through this and learn through it. You know, because my whole life I've been trying to avoid pain, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. I didn't have to deal. When I drank, it just removed that. I didn't have to ever grow through anything or think through anything or walk through anything. I just removed myself from the equation, and I felt above it, you know. And unfortunately, when we get sober, it's like I had to live life on life's terms again. And I need to grow up, and that absolutely, quite literally, grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I was a child. And so that's when the process had started. You know, my sponsor had me take a third step, and I absolutely identified with the actor trying to run the show, you know, that I'm somebody who my whole life and still today can think that if I just arrange life to suit myself, if I check all these boxes and arrange all these pieces the way that I think that they should be arranged, that I will be happy and you will be happy, you know, and I often want to play God, not in just my life, but everybody else's life around me. And, you know, and when it said that we stepped on the toes of our fellows and they retaliated, I saw, and then when I wrote a fourth step, I quite literally saw that in every relationship in my life, I had manipulated, I had taken, I had, you know, used them some way, whether materially, emotionally, physically, and I was not a victim. You know, I'm somebody that just is stomping on the toes of fellows. They retaliate, and then I'm waving a victim flag, you know? And it really showed me that I'm not a nice girl that drank too much. I am selfish and self-centered, and then I had all this fear, you know, that permeated my life. My whole everything, you know, everything that I did, the way that I operated was just based out of self-centered fear. You know, was I going to get what I wanted? Was I going to lose what I had? Is that person getting what they want, taking it from what I want? You know, and I just felt like I was living on this state of deprivation, like there wasn't enough to go around, you know. And when you live like that, it's like you're an animal, you know. I mean, total primal instincts. And you know, I never thought about anybody else. I never considered anybody else's feeling. I just was absolutely reacting to what I wanted, you know. And these lessons in swallowing these pieces of truth for myself, you know, although painful, helped set me free. You know, I could tell you that somewhere after that fourth and fifth step and allowing my sponsor to be the first human being to know all of me, you know, really, because I had always been a chameleon, right? I'll give you different. There were so many versions of Joyce out there that I could barely keep my story straight. Of, you know, and even in that first, fourth, and fifth step, there were so many lies that I had come to believe and been deluded to be true, that there were like imaginary people on that fourth step, you know, imaginary situations. And I had internalized it because I had told these lies so many times that I'd actually believe them, you know, and to start to wake up to what the truth was, you know, and who I actually was. You know, and I ended up, my early sobriety, I spent up in New Jersey. I ended up moving back up there for a job that I walked out on, you know, just a lot of bad newcomer decisions in my first couple of years, you know, like running away, taking important jobs that I thought were going to fix me, that I, you know, would fail, running away to try to, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus, the relationship that was going to fix me that would eventually fail, you know, and this constant, and dead sober, you know, this constant grasping for this and that to still fix that hole inside of me, which only the relationship with a loving God could fix, you know. And I have slammed against that wall many a time, you know. I thought that an education, that once I was able to finish school, that I would be able, that would fix it. You know, then I got my degree and it didn't fix it. Then I was like, well, maybe I'll get a better degree and then that will fix it. You know, and I was like this maddening obsession that owned me, you know, that if, again, dead sober, if I could arrange my sobriety to look like what I think it should look like, then I will be happy. You know, and again, like the lesson for me that has surrendered me over and over and over again is that I cannot run the show, you know, and I don't know. I don't know what's going to help me. I don't know what's going to make me happy. Is that I have chased these, you know, my sponsor used to say, like newcomers are like baby, you know, just shiny things. I'd like to see a shiny thing. I just start running after it, you know. I just have no idea what it is. It looks shiny, though, and I just start chasing it, you know, with blinders on. And then I wake, come to, and I realize I'm so off in left field, and where how do I get back? And I call my sponsor and I ask for help, and you know, you all navigate me back on the path here. And a lot of that, you know, is through 6 and 7. And those steps in my early sobriety, I really felt like were so easy. You know, it's like I did my 4th and 5th step. I said that prayer. I read those 2 paragraphs in the big book, and I was like, that was easy. And I closed the book, and I went on living my defective, you know, selfish, self-centered life. And I had no idea that. That's what I would be contending with for the rest of my life. You know, is these broken beliefs, these, you know, the way that I operated, you know, that everything like that was going to have to change. And I had no idea of how many old ideas still dominated me, you know, about women primarily. You know, I had a male sponsor for the first 6 years of my sobriety. I hated women. I couldn't foster any relationship with any friendship with women other than the people I sponsored. That was the only women that I allowed into my life were women that I sponsored. And I lived that sequestered life purposefully, you know, because I was unwilling to let go of these old belief systems that I had about what it meant to be a woman, you know. And I remember hitting that wall and seeing, you know, that this was just yet another area of my life I was trying to manage, and I was depriving myself of being able to experiencing anything different, you know. And I can honestly say that through a process of making amends to my mother's grave, you know, and people in my home group that badgered me, you know, I'd be like, I don't want any friends, you know. I'm like that, I'm sober, I'm like, I still have this wall and this arm that I, stiff arm I put out, you know, like I would only let people in so much. And you know, my these women on this path that were further ahead of me constantly loving me and hugging me, and I'd like, my skin would crawl, you know. I was like, it's still an ongoing joke, I'm like a notorious side hugger, you know. I mean, I just could not be intimate and really let anybody in, quite literally, you know. And they were relentless, you know. And that's another common thread throughout my sobriety, is that if I allowed myself to dictate how well I got here, I would sell myself short. You know, that the people here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, this fellowship want more for you than we want for ourselves. You know, and making amends to my mother's grave and being able to talk to women and to grieve that sober, you know, began to open up my heart in a way and be able to participate, like sitting down at celebration dinners with women I sponsor and their families. And to talk honestly with my sponsor about how that would break my heart, you know, to hear them talk about their moms and the relationships they were having. I mean, and something began to happen and shift, you know, and lo and behold, it's like, and it's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it absolutely materialized for me, you know, is that I began to form these relationships. And today I have a woman sponsor that continues to show me how to live and how to be and how to act, you know. And, you know, another part of my journey that I always mention, because second to the obsession of alcohol being removed, you know, one of the biggest portions of struggles of my sobriety has been my resentment against my father. You know, as I've described to you, we had a very toxic relationship. I had decades of, you know, case files built up against him and lots of co-signers, you know, lots of professionals that had signed off on how wrong he was and all that, and I carried all that baggage here to into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all would not let me continue to carry it around, you know. And the freedom I was able to experience because I was, you all would not let me stay in my illness, you know. I wanted to stay angry. I wanted to stay a victim, and constantly, you know, my sponsor would remind me, how free do you want to be? You know, did you not at the beginning of this process, you know, tell me that you were willing to go to any lengths, and this is part of any lengths, and that I would have to forgive this man, and that I would have to do what the book said and focus on my wrongs, my harms, my shortcomings, and the inventory would be mine to take. And, you know, for years, I didn't have a relationship with my father. We had very minimal contact. And throughout the years, through sponsor direction, you know, I wrote letters. I visited monthly. You know, we had call times where I would connect with him and I would pray. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I'd be punching walls, so angry at God, so angry at you guys that I don't want to have to live principally. You know, I want to be an asshole. You know, I want to be able to react. I don't want to practice restraint of pen and tongue. You know, I want to lash out. And then praying that anger down and submitting it to this inventory process and submitting it in this prayer process, you know, is that something began to shift and that anger was removed, you know. And just to come full circle, I mean, just this past December I got married. And fell in love with a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous, God help us. And, you know, my father walked me down the aisle. You know, my dad and I had a daughter, father-daughter dance, and he sang me a song. It's like, you know, that's impossible. You know, at the end of my drinking, my dad and I were throwing chairs at each other, threatening to break each other's faces. Like, literally, that's something that we would say on the regular, is that I'm going to break your face. And here's this man, you know, crying with me as we walk down the aisle in this church. And I would have missed it all. You know, I absolutely would have missed it all. I would have sold myself short, because what I do is I cut and run. You know, if anything's hard, if any relationship is difficult, I just want to remove it and run away. I don't want to work through things, you know. And today I try to live in 10, 11, and 12. You know, I went out, I made amends. You know, obviously I made amends to my mom, my dad. I had to make amends to family members. I paid restitution back to places that I stole from. I mean, I had to make that stuff right, because that's the stuff that ate me up on the inside. You know, when I would lay awake at night after running around in Alcoholics Anonymous, those were the things that were still playing through my head, the things that I had done, the things that had happened to me. And until I cleaned that up, I couldn't really be free here. You know, and 10, 11, and 12, I mean, that has been, I mean, where the rubber meets the road. You know, I have been absolutely guilty of checking these boxes. And at the time, when I remember when I made the last amends that I could make, I felt like, whew, I'm done. You know, I'm going to kick up my feet and relax and get mine. You know, let's focus on Joyce and what Joyce wants. And I had no idea that, you know, what I have here is a daily reprieve contingent on maintenance of my spiritual condition. I mean, daily means daily. You know, I thought that if I worked really hard those first like 6 years, and if I could just relax for the next six, I'll be good. You know, I felt like I had my like I was like depositing into a piggy bank, and I could make a lot of withdrawals on it, you know. And unfortunately, I mean, those credits do not transfer. Those points don't carry over, and I have to start afresh every single day, which sounded awful at first, but thankfully a lot of times I'm glad. You know, I'm glad that I can start over every single day, because there are some days where I mess up real bad, you know, real bad, and I make a mess of things that I'm still selfish and self-centered to this day. I mean, I always like to share about where I'm at. And like I shared, I mean, I got married in December. I now have a husband and a stepdaughter, and I have a career because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a very full life, you know, and I'm so blessed. I have, you know, relationships with members of Alcoholics Anonymous and people that I've met along my path here, both in and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm part of my family that want me to be a part of the family and ask me to show up. And I can get so I can miss the whole picture, you know, and I could feel entitled. I could feel bitter that, oh my God, another event to show up for, you know, another new girl calling my phone, or, you know, and I lose the gratitude and the perspective that these are unbelievable gifts, you know, and that it is more. I mean, I could look at my bank account and feel like it's not enough, you know, I always want to tell on myself about that, because that's a type of ego that I have, you know, that I am insatiable to the core, and that it will never be enough for this alcoholic, you know, that that's why it's only God that can fill that hole. You know, it doesn't matter how many people are in my life, how many friendships, how much love and support I have. It's like, if I don't have a real relationship with a God of my understanding, it's still frothy emotional appeal. You know, and if I don't spend my days and my time trying to give this away and remembering what I have, then I've missed the whole point. You know, and recently I have had a lot of friends in the past 3 years that have had double-digit sobriety, and their lives have gotten so beautiful here. And then one day I get a phone call and they say, well, I don't think I'm alcoholic. You know, and nothing turns my stomach more, because that's what I've seen. It's not when we're insane, you know, when I'm going through a tough time and tragedy has struck, that I'm scared of leaving. It's when life gets good, because that's what I've seen, you know, my fellow members that I've walked and, you know, trudged this path with for years, you know, that their talks from the podium have moved me to tears. You know, and I've identified with them, and here they are, you know, 15, 18 years later, saying, well, maybe it was just a phase. And that is how cunning, baffling, and powerful that this illness is, you know, and that I have more at stake to lose now, and that not just that, but this illness is just so much more cunning, you know, that it doesn't come at me like, you should go out and drink normally. You know, it comes at me like, well, you've gone to enough meetings this week, or you've done enough. You know, you don't need to take that other commitment. Or you sponsor enough people, you don't need to extend your hand to that new girl. And it starts to, my mind begins to turn on me in that way. And that's why I still need a sponsor, you know. And I call my sponsor regularly. She knows my inventory, you know, and I'm willing to listen to her. And I still give her veto power over every area of my life. And when I feel like I don't want to give her veto power, that's like the biggest red flag for me, that, you know, I'm up to something no good. and I still need help, you know. I mean, just last Sunday, I was sitting in my car again, overwhelmed with my self-centeredness, hysterically crying, you know, wondering, I can't do this. You know, I'm too tired. I'm messing up everywhere, you know, because I don't know how to be a stepmom. I don't know how to be a wife. That I don't know how to wear these multiple hats or live these multiple lives. And that's the way I was looking at it. And my sponsor reminded me, it's not multiple lives or multiple hats. It's just one life. And you just have to live principally. You need to live authentically as one person. And me trying to compartmentalize these areas of my life, I mean, that is when I start getting manic, and I'm playing God again, you know, I'm playing God again, and that, and I start running the show. And that's always the tell for a girl like me. When I start hysterically crying and, you know, acting like a toddler, I mean, that's like my red flag, you know. Joyce is self-will run riot. And I'm grateful that I've never been able to keep a really good face, you know, that when I'm up to no good. I mean, I remember that night I went to my home group. You know, it had been hours since I've been crying. I felt like I pulled it together. I prayed, and I put my best face at my home group. And multiple people came up to me and said, what's wrong? You know? And as frustrating and humiliating as that is, like, I hope I can stay teachable, you know, and I hope that I never feel that I need to be too good for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to be accountable to people, you know. And one of those girls is somebody I sponsored. I'm like, you got some nerve, you know. And that's the other thing, too, is, like, the women that I sponsor have been my greatest teachers, you know. That I had a big misconception about sponsorship for a good majority of my sobriety, and then I learned, you know, that it's not this, I want to fix them, I want to manage them, you know. It's that we're going to walk together, You know, we're gonna walk together, and the best thing that I can do is show you what I'm doing. You know, I spent a lot. I'm a talker. You know, I could talk. I'd be saying things I didn't even, wasn't even in my wheelhouse of experience. But, and I always felt like I need to have the answer. You know, I want to have the right answer. I want to know what to say. And so much of my God that I've experienced and worked through me has been in the silence. You know, the sitting and waiting and saying, I don't know. You know, so with that, I am so grateful to be here and to share with you and to be on this journey with many of you that I've known for years. So I hope that we continue to walk this path together. And thanks for letting me share. Woo!